Welcome to Free Thoughts from Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute. I'm Aaron Powell.
I'm Matthew Feeney.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Joining us today is Brian Wilson. He's co-founder of Combating Classics, a program out of St. John's that organizes free online seminars on classic texts for active duty, reserve, and veteran U.S. military. He's joining us today to discuss Plato's Apology. But Brian, let's maybe kick things off by having you tell us a bit about Combating Classics.
Sure. Combating Classics is sponsored by St. John's College. It's an outreach program through St. John's. I'm a graduate of the Graduate Institute in Annapolis. And when I was kind of transitioning from student to alumnus, approached the dean of the college and just said, you know, hey, what can I do for you guys? And they just really wanted to get kind of more involvement with the military. And we thought the best way to do that was just by what we do at St. John's, which is just Socratic dialogue and great books just with a military audience.
And is it coming over pretty well? Do you get – I mean, are there any texts that you tend to focus on mostly in that, or is it pretty broad? Is it classic philosophy or plays or Greek and Roman or anything?
Yeah. I mean the degree from St. John's, right, is liberal arts. And so we study everything from Euclid to Newton, to Aristophanes, to Plato, to basically the kind of classical liberal education. So we try to represent that as best we can with combat and classics. We do probably do a little bit more history and philosophy, a little bit more Thucydides, a little bit more Herodotus, a little bit more Plato. But we try to get in a good amount of things that, you know, maybe somebody who's looking at the great books and is in the military has already started on. But for instance, our April and our March and April seminars are both Macbeth. So we'll be doing Shakespeare for those. But our February upcoming seminars on the Iliad. So we do, you know, kind of a martial theme to a certain extent, but it's a broad swath of classical literature that we use.
Well, then I guess let's turn to our text we chose today. Plato's Apology, which is one that you've done seminars on.
Yeah.
So give us some background on it.
So the Apology is Socrates on trial, right? He is apparently corrupted the youth. He is accused of being a heretic, of not believing in the gods. And this is Socrates, you would call, lackluster defense of those charges. But also a robust defense of what it means to be an individual, to be able to stand up to the state, and what is the consequences of that for both the individual and the state.
Why would you call the defense lackluster?
I think that, you know, and Socrates, I think, admits this to a certain extent. He's, you know, Meletus, his accuser, has kind of made his case, and Socrates is replying, and that's the beginning of the dialogue, is Socrates' reply. And, you know, he says, like, what Meletus has said is, and the accusers at large, is just not true, right? But it sways the jury, right? And it's obvious that it swayed the jury. And he says, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to play this game. I'm just going to do what I do, which is seek truth, right? Examine virtue. And if you guys don't like that, all right, no big deal. And he's willing to accept the consequences of that decision of being kind of true to himself rather than, you know, I'm going to make a case to get myself out of punishment.
Should we interpret this as I've never gotten a good handle on the theistic, I guess I'm trying to – piety of the Greeks, of how much – are they kind of like modern day Christians who, if you don't believe in their gods – as I always thought with if you are – if you believe in many gods, then you believe that you kind of accept other people who believe in those gods too and don't treat them as atheists as much. So are these trumped up charges? Are we sort of like this impiety? Was it the worst thing in ancient Greece to believe in different gods than those god and this corruption of views? Should we interpret them as trumped up charges?
No, I think it's pretty clear that they are trumped up. You know, whether or not Socrates was an actual theist or an atheist or what is kind of one of those things that and I know that Cato has talked about this in the past as far as like, you know, how much of a deist was Thomas Jefferson and George Washington? And so it's those kind of things where it's like, you know, only the people that only you know, you know, how much you buy into whatever religious creed you might or might not espouse. And so there were certainly questions that Socrates raised that could make people uncomfortable. But there's no statement that I can think of in the entire kind of Platonic canon where he comes out and says, I don't believe any of this stuff, right? But it's the questioning that certainly causes this accusation to get carried forward and certainly swayed a decent amount of the jury.
I think it's pretty clear he's not a straight up atheist.
Yeah.
Like he very obviously, and he defends himself along these lines by saying, look, I talk all the time and tell people all the time about
demigods
and demons and other things that assume
the
existence
of gods. Does he mean like Hercules? Is that what he is, like Hercules a demigod?
Yeah. I mean, he talks about the demigods. He talks about the offspring of, you know, gods and men and I think you can. It's very much a Rorschach test, I think, for the reader, right? If you want to read that as if you're an atheist reader approaching the text, then you can go, "Oh, he's messing with these guys." But if you're a theist reader, then you can go, "No, he's trying to fit it into this theist doctrine that's, you know, part of the community, and he's, you know, just trying to play by those rules." And
well,
may or may not believe him.
I mean, it's certainly the case. I mean, at least toward the end, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but that he postulates after death there are a couple of possibilities, and one is that it's just an eternal kind of sleep, and the other is, hey, I've got to hang out with Homer and yeah, all these other guys. But he seems and so at the beginning there's this question when he speaks to the oracle, and it seems like hard to believe someone not taking that seriously without some sort of theistic belief. If you really don't believe that the oracle was the voice of a god, then his walking around Athens trying to see if he could find someone wiser than him seems a little pointless.
One final question I want to ask before – we may open up a bag of worms here, but before we get fully into the text is this a history?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine on that. I think that you know, I always liked Christopher Hitchens' kind of description of Socrates versus Jesus. You know, it's like it's not important if you're looking at Socrates whether or not he existed at all, right? You can take his teachings and you can take whatever you want out of that, right? And it's not important if he existed or didn't exist or if this is what he said or didn't say. You know?
But it's a little different because in this one, I think one of two maybe of Plato's dialogues, Plato is supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he was taking notes. So that it kind of brings that specter a little
bit more.
But
I think this is complicated by – so we only have two accounts of Socrates' defense.
Mm-hmm.
We have Plato's
Diogenes,
and then
Xenophon,
who is another follower of Socrates. But then at the same time there's this after Socrates' death, it was kind of a thing for writers to write their own versions of his defense. It was like just fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also probably kind of like a Rorschach test. They all wrote it in the way that they saw
yes.
Socrates.
And so it's a little bit difficult. Like we have almost no texts. What we do know about Socrates largely comes from Plato and Xenophon, and Plato very clearly drifts away from presenting anything that even is remotely, you know, historical or documentary in his later dialogues, where we get to just these are Plato's ideas and Socrates is a mouthpiece for them. There's the argument made that I think seems relatively persuasive to me that of the two apologies that we have, Plato's and Xenophon's, like Xenophon, well, a smart guy, was not a genius on the level of Plato. And so it's less so Plato's genius probably takes over a bit more in his presentation. But they're similar enough, although it's the Xenophon's Socrates is not – his speech is not the great work of literature that we read for today and is quite a bit more straightforward. But the skeleton is relatively the same. So we could probably say – I mean there's some level of accuracy there, but we don't know. So I think largely when we're talking about Socrates, we're analyzing Socrates in the way that we would talk about Hamlet, right? Like we act as if we analyze him as a real person while recognizing too that he was a historical figure. But what we're really talking about is Plato's presentation of him.
So let's talk about that skeleton then. How does the dialogue open up?
Well, the dialogue, I mean, it rolls right into the defense, right? And there's no – which I always find interesting is that there's not really a presentation of the accuser's argument. You know, it is just the defense. And you have to kind of start with that question. I mean, there is a dialogue that's supposed to have happened right before the trial, which is the Euthyphro, which I know I'm pronouncing wrong because my Greek is pretty terrible. But they don't really talk much about Socrates' trial, right? They talk about Euthyphro's trial for manslaughter. So we open with this, and Socrates immediately kind of goes for underwhelming. You know, he says, "I do not know what effect my accusers have had upon you." He's speaking to the jury. "But for my own part, I was almost carried away by them. Their arguments were so convincing. On the other hand, scarcely a word of what they said was true."
It's a wonderful line to read during a presidential election.
Yeah.
Should we be picturing him in an amphitheater type situation with like in a, I picture this as a circle with the people sitting on benches around him while speaking to them. Is that a?
I always kind of think about it as like Perry Mason. That's
okay. It was these kind of juries. I think were done. I forget the name of the location, but it's quite close to the Acropolis, and it would have been about for the time about 500 people would have been hearing the accusation and the defense. On the top of this rather small hill in Athens.
Yeah, I think that the police procedural has just kind of tainted my visualization a little bit too much. So I'm visualizing Law and Order.
Mm-hmm. And the setup, just the setup of this trial and the way it functions is, I think, something we could talk about because it's fairly interesting as a contrast to the way that we do things now.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, he has this jury of 500 people, right? And it seems obvious to me that they've been fairly swayed by the accusers. What we usually do at St. John's when we're opening a seminar, when we're talking about something like this, is that the tutor will just ask an opening question. Mm-hmm. And from there, there's not really we're trying to stick to the reading as much as possible. Obviously, you're the hosts and you're the Cato Institute. So if we want to talk about the Iowa caucus, then go for it, but
please no.
Probably not. But we just try to stick to the text as much as we can for our points and for our questions. So the question I would like to ask you is, what is Socrates' mindset during this trial?
So I think that's a great opening because if you think about the timeline here, he's already an old man,
70,
which is be considered pretty old now, let alone in ancient Greece. And reading the defense, I got the impression that he might be just sort of resigned to the way this might end and the way it will end because he's an old man and the way he's addressing it, he discusses how death isn't particularly that bad and the important thing is to lead a good life and that you shouldn't calculate the chances of living or dying. You should think about doing the right thing versus the wrong thing, and maybe if I die, I'll be able to an eternal sleep or talk to people I admire and I can continue these conversations. So part of me thinks his mindset might be, well, I could be doomed, but at least I can go out in a great rhetorical flourish and make these people look a little silly. And I think he succeeds in doing that, especially with Meletus, that accuser.
Well, I agree with Matthew. I think also that I always read Socrates as so tongue-in-cheek, the way he spoke to people, that I kind of I kind of read the apology as him being kind of angry and his righteousness against the accusing apparatus. And this is why I think it is a libertarian-ish text or something we can learn, just political philosophy about a person standing against a power who has the righteous position, which he discusses later on. And if you do think you have the righteous position – and if, I mean, that's the way Socrates does everything. Do you think – he would never say it. He'd be like, you know, he's like, what do you think? Socrates, do you have the righteous position? He's like, I don't know, sir. Do you think I have the righteous position? Are cows righteous? He would never say it, but you know he does think this. Mm-hmm. And now he's going to stand in front of the polis, which is a much more community-oriented type of concept than the current state. But – and then tell them basically like a pox on your on both your houses or all of you. And that's – so I see anger.
Yeah, that was my reading more so than just resignation was – the righteousness coming in because he's – so he tells us this story of the Oracle at Delphi saying that he's the wisest man alive and that he's basically built a career around trying to assess that because he doesn't think of himself as wise but – which of course I think he really does but he just – likes to think he's not. And it's because he recognizes his lack of wisdom that the oracle thinks he's the most wise. But to kind of test this, he goes around asking people who are presumed to be wise and testing their wisdom and always finding it lacking. And he's got this other part where he goes in about the training of the horses, right? Where he says, you wouldn't when you want to break a horse, you call in an expert. You don't just have like everyone break the horse because that's not going to work. And that seems to be a dig against this system. And so I read this as look, I've been going around showing all of you up, and now you've done this dumb thing where you're putting me on trial. And so it's not just that I'm kind of resigned to my fate and I don't really think that living over 70 would be all that awesome anyway, and death isn't something to worry about, but also that, you know, I'm going to prove like my last act will be proving that I was right all along by showing the complete lack of wisdom of all of you. And that seems to be because he's constantly provoking them. This isn't just like a lackluster defense. This is like, come and get me. Right. And so even when he's given like every opportunity, and we get that in the follow-up dialogue, the credo, where he's given the opportunity after he's been convicted to run away and he just doesn't take it. Like at every step, he seems to want them to kill him. You know, even when – I mean they've declared him guilty and he offers up these basically absurd alternative sentences that he knows they're going to reject. He just – he seems angry and he seems like – he wants to demonstrate the foolishness of the people of Athens.
Yeah, I mean I like the idea of anger just because, you know, right at 28, he kind of has a external-internal dialogue and says, "But perhaps someone will say, do you feel no compunction, Socrates, in having followed a line of action which puts you in danger of the death penalty? I might fairly reply to him, you are mistaken, my friend, if you think that a man who is worth anything ought to spend his time weighing up the prospects of life and death." And he gives the example of Achilles, right, which we have this, you know, whole book of Homer about, and the first word of that is menace, right, rage. And it's Singo muse of the rage of Achilles. And so he kind of brings it off and the whole presentation, I mean, you can obviously, if you're directing this, you can, you know, get a Mickey Rourke in there, or you can, you know, kind of get somebody a little bit more relaxed. But, you know, the rage is there, right? I mean, it's right in the dialogue when he brings up Achilles. But what's interesting to me is that, you know, he says right there, you know, the idea of even questioning that, right? The idea of, you know, thinking about that is – but that's what Achilles did for, you know, half the book. And so I feel like there's kind of a maybe a duality there of he's saying it's wrong, but he might also be implying that there's a certain bit of human nature in wanting to spare yourself. Do any of you feel like Socrates tries at any point to kind of at least give himself some breathing room in the dialogue to maybe – you know, convince the jury I'm not as big a threat as you think I am?
I think that he certainly does make fools of the accusers and make the charges sound ridiculous. But I think as Aaron alluded to earlier, after the vote where he's found guilty, but not by a particularly large margin, and Socrates says, well, I'm glad that you didn't, that I got some support here, but then goes on to propose that they give him a pension, or that they, that some, you know, comparatively meager fine be imposed. And he must have known that that would lose him what support he probably did have. And then, you know, instead of a sort of sensible negotiation or proposal, he's sentenced to death. And I think that that's quite telling.
Well, I think that the interesting – he does try to some extent, but this at the beginning he mentions Aristophanes, the cloud – the clouds, which kind of parodies Socrates. But he seems like a guy who believes that popular opinion is of one thing about him. Like if you imagine a star today and everyone thinks that like there's some sort of rumor about someone and that there's really nothing he can do to change this, especially because I do think that he believes that most people are stupid. And so he says, well, I get up there and I talk to a bunch of stupid people who have an idea about me because of this opinion that's in the clouds and other sort of just rumors about me, and I'm not going to convince them at all. But I think he does try, or at least tries to make a case for the few people who might be willing to listen to him to some degree.
Well, that was – I mean, teasing out this whether like, because he defends himself, but whether it's an attempt to soften it, as you asked, or just to not, I guess, give in to what he sees as false charges, because he, you know, he could have just said, "Okay, you're right," and then throw himself on the mercy of the court, or not really mounted much of a defense if he didn't care one way or another, but it seems like his defense is, I guess, why I had a difficult time figuring out is how much of the defense was like him trying to, like, "I don't want to be punished, and so I'm going to try to defend myself," versus, "I totally don't care what happens to me, and in fact would like to be punished because it would prove me right, but I can't stand by," and because he talks about how much what ultimately matters is not wealth, it's not prestige, it's the kind of person you are, it's your principles, and so he's not going to, he's going to defend his honor and his principles against these false charges, but it doesn't matter what happens to him ultimately.
Can we compare this to, I mean, it has been, of course, but can we compare this to Jesus in front of Pontius Pilate, in the sense of Jesus offering a defense against a crowd with a huge bias against him and saying nothing in response to their claims of his own type of disobedience of the Pharisees? I think it's very similar, except for Jesus was a little bit more taciturn.
Yeah, so I haven't actually heard much about that comparison, but I think what they both have in common is that to a contemporary 21st century reader in Washington, D.C., it's the thing that Socrates and Jesus do seem to have in common is that they're being accused of what's effectively thought crime. In the sense, like, you have the wrong kind of ideas, and you're being too persuasive to people, and all this other sort of stuff.
But in our post rationalization, because they kind of both start movements, or these texts are at least written for the purpose of starting a movement. In both of these, they're just like, "Well, I'm going to die, and my death's going to be a lesson." I mean, it's a really big lesson for Jesus, but they've just sort of resigned themselves to the fate, and so we see a trial, which again has a righteousness of standing against the power that is arrayed against you.
Yeah, and it is the case that Socrates does say, I think, at the end, something like, "Look, you're going to think yourself a little silly," and I think he's been proven right.
Well, there's a Pharisaic quality to the people who are accusing him. I mean, and that's what these three accusers, who I think are just some sort of, they represent classes.
Yeah.
If I read that correctly.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I kind of tie this in more is I feel like that Plato. I mean, obviously, this is an important part of the canon, right? Of the Platonic canon, an important part of Socrates. I don't know if you need it. You know, like you need the Pontius Pilate story to have a, you know, serious impact on Christianity. I don't know if you need the apology to make, you know, Socrates understood. But it is important. But I would compare it more to something like Kafka's The Trial, you know, something like Orwell, something like, you know, Eileen Chang's Naked Earth, where it's you're against the state, right? And that and Socrates lays it out, right? He says very specifically around 31C, he basically says, he says, you know, "I don't mess with the state because I know what's going to happen," right? The last part of 31C, "The true champion of justice, if he intends to survive even for a short time, must necessarily confine himself to private life and leave politics alone," right? So and he's tried to go out of his way to do this, but the state doesn't care, right? The state, just by questioning any aspect of its doctrine, is going to get insulted, right?
I like how he keeps bringing up how he makes no money. It kind of – there's a lot of things that – as a lawyer, there's a lot of things in the world where the state can't get you until you're making money off of it. they don't have any jurisdiction over you until you're making money off of it. So he's like, "Hey, I'm just doing this, you know, my own private life. Private's private."
Yeah. Know? Well, and the thing is that this is the only thing that – the only two things that they could threaten, right, was first saying, "You can't do this anymore," right? And it was important for him to be able to do it, and in Athens. And then the only other thing was his life, right? And so if he wants to take that kind of binary look and say, you know, if this or that, it does show how necessary he sees exploring, you know, what is the virtuous life as at least critical for him. And I think that, you know, that example obviously shines through in a very robust way in what he's talking about. You know, something that we talk about because we've done this seminar a couple times with the military audience is right around line 29. And he says, "The truth of the matter is this, gentlemen," and this is right after the Achilles comparison. "The truth of the matter is this, gentlemen. Where a man has once taken up his stand, either because it seems best to him or in obedience to his orders, there I believe he is bound to remain and face the danger, taking no account of death or anything else before dishonor. This being so, it would be shocking. It would be a shocking inconsistency on my part, gentlemen, if when the officers whom you chose to command me assigned me my position at Potidaea and Amphipolis and in Delium, I remained at my post like anyone else and faced death. And yet afterwards, when God appointed me, as I supposed and believed, the duty of leading the philosophic life, examining myself and others, I were then through fear of death or any other danger to desert my post." And so, well, that's like super fiery, uppy for like libertarians. You know, you have to wonder how effective that is. You know, how effective is that analogy to you as readers? How effective potentially is that for a military reader? I mean, it certainly puts, I think, a lot of military readers kind of on the horns of a dilemma. Is, you know, there is this idea of death before dishonor. You know, what? Why is Socrates so set on, you know, either not teaching philosophy as more dishonorable than death?
Well, I think it might strike us as maybe a little odd as readers now to hear that rhetoric, especially coming from someone who was a philosopher. But I think it's important to remember that Socrates was a soldier for a while and that one of the accusers is a general who fought the Spartans in the Peloponnesian War, and that a lot of people in Athens at the time would have understood the role of the military and would probably have served. And I think it's some sort of appeal. And of course, saying "I'm just like Achilles" is a clear, you know, everyone in ancient Greece would have known the reference clearly, and Homeric legends were very popular. And of course, Achilles had this "living with dishonor is worse than death," and that even if I know I'm dead after I fight and kill Hector, that's worthwhile. And he seems to view his own death. I mean, I think the Socrates' arrogance is on display in a number of places. But my favorite example of that was when he says, "Maybe if I die, I can my death will be like other people who died unjustly." And he cites Palamedes, who was of course sent to get Odysseus, the great trickster, to come to Troy. And Palamedes tricked the trickster because Odysseus tried to pretend to be insane, was sowing salt into the earth, and Palamedes put Odysseus' son Telemachus in front of the plow and tricked Odysseus because Odysseus wasn't going to cut his own son in half with the plow. And I just find that a really interesting comparison, that when he says my death will be like other unjust deaths, and that it's deaths of at least one particularly clever person, is really quite telling. But no, I think going back to the original line of inquiry here, that the military rhetoric is very deliberate, and I think he must have known that it would have pulled on the heartstrings of a few of the people on the jury.
Well, a lot of this tradition of death before dishonor, or anyone from Gandhi to Martin Luther King to all people standing against and saying, "I will not, you know, I will not forsake my principles for this thing that's standing against me that has none of these principles at all." It resonates with almost everyone. I mean, movies, everything is made after this, and you can always sort of put a libertarian spin on this. But I think it's interesting that this is something I hadn't noticed before that. And I don't have the exact locations, unfortunately, that you do for the official version. But he's done this before. Socrates talks about the 30 and like how he had done this before. He had stood against the 30
tyrants.
But when the oligarchy of the 30 was in power, they sent me and four others into the rotunda and bade us bring Leon the Salaminian from Salamis, as they wanted to put him to death. This was a specimen of the sort of commands which they were always giving with a view of implicating as many as possible in their crimes. So we get this – basically some sort of Stalinist despotism, just killing people left and right. And then I showed not in word only but in deed that if I may be allowed to use such an expression, I cared not a straw for death, and that my great and only care was lest I should do an unrighteous or unholy thing. For the strong arm of that oppressive power did not frighten me into doing wrong. And when we came out of the rotunda, the other four went to Salamis and fetched Leon, but I went quietly home, for which I might have lost my life had not the power of the 30 shortly afterwards come to an end, and many will witness my words. So it's kind of interesting that at some point, and I'm not sure historically how long ago that was, he had made a habit of this death before unrighteousness kind of thing.
Yeah, the historical context here is interesting because this sort of – this oligarchy, this pro-Spartan set of tyrants were – in charge of Athens. And
do you know what years?
So this was 404 BC.
So just 5 years before.
Yeah, it was very recent.
It was very recent, and I think the apologies to the historians if that's wrong. But it was recent, and I think there are certainly people who claim that part of the accusation against Socrates was that he stuck around in Athens and certainly knew the leader of these tyrants and that was not perceived as particularly.
He was actually, I mean, he was like a mentor of Critias, who was
right,
the leader of the tyrants. I mean, so that's
so he's like a Vichy.
So to
like
some
a,
extent, like because we reading this thousands of years later, we look, you know, this looks very bad for the people of Athens, right? But I think that we can defend them a bit in the sense that, you know, the historical situation, you had Athens' democracy. It was taken over by these tyrants. Things were very bad. Socrates had been the mentor of the leader of the tyrants. He had also been the friend and mentor of Alcibiades, who had worked against the democracy, had been kicked out, had run off to Sparta, was pro-Spartan. Socrates is at least presented by Plato seems to like a lot of elements of the Spartan regime. He didn't leave when the 30 took over. And then my understanding is when the 30 left, there was a treaty that was signed that granted some degree of amnesty to people who were involved in it. And so if the people of Athens were mad at him for what looked like support of the 30, and then there was this also notion in Greece at the time that like the mentor was to some degree always responsible for the actions of his students because it was his job to teach them and they were carrying out his teachings. And so they could blame Socrates for what happened. But the treaty prevents them from trying him for that. And so this is possibly a run around the treaty. You know, so it doesn't look – so we can still judge them harshly, but there may have been – complicating factors here, which is why these charges look so silly.
It's kind of like the Kafka essay that Brian mentioned.
So if we can, you know, this is all good background. I don't mean to turn us off on this, but within the text and taking into account those kind of historical precedents, why did Socrates stick around through all this, through the tyrants, through Alcibiades' defection? And through this trial, he has no property, right? I mean, that's what ties us to the state in a lot of ways, right? We usually have property, and it's hard to move it. Why did he stick around?
Righteousness again, I'm going to say.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you know he's an old man. He might just not be up for you know this political uncertainty and going into fleeing Athens. Although you know, whatever his reasons, I think it would be mistaken to think that he was some sort of supporter of this oligarchy, that he was pro this tyranny. And I think it would be a little unfair.
But he does seem anti-democracy.
Sure. But these can be mutually exclusive, right? You can be anti-democracy and also anti the tyranny at the time. That's a good, I think, historical question. I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows.
I mean he gives reasons. This is on the next text, so I won't. But he does give some reasons for sticking around in the Credo, which is when his followers show up while he's in jail waiting execution and say, "Look, we can get you out of here. It'll be easy. We just bribe the guards. Kind of everyone's expecting you to do
it's
it.
Like
Let's
El Chapo,
leave.
Yeah.
And he says no, and he presents these reasons. And every intern semester, I give a talk to the interns about the credo and about obligations to obey the law and say that Socrates' arguments are all terrible. But he does have these arguments. But my sense, I mean, from this and from just what we know of him as his character is, I mean, Athens is his home. Socrates seems like a creature of habit. I mean, to the degree that I think one of the more delightful parts of this text is at the end when he's talking about, so Socrates is, he would be a hard guy to live around. I mean, he just goes around harassing people. Like,
he'd be a horrible next door neighbor.
He's a pain in the ass.
He'd be like a Jehovah's Witness next door neighbor that just never stopped knocking on your
door. But he's a historically epic pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't, when he's talking about death at the end, and he's like, death is nothing to fear because on the one hand, it might be oblivion, which he
like
then
a really
says is
good
like,
night's
which
sleep.
Is a really good night's sleep. Or there's an afterlife, and in the afterlife, I can go and harass all of those people too. You know, and you can imagine all of these like great Greek heroes looking down from the afterlife and just saying, please don't kill him, please don't kill him. But he just seems to be like, he just knows this way of life. This is what he does. And that's my reading of, to a large extent, why he doesn't leave. There's the principal reason, like he doesn't think he should have to, but he just this is what he knows. This is his home. This is what he's been doing for years.
Your comment about being anti-democracy, but before the passage I read about the 30, he seems to call that the days of the democracy. And again, I don't know how much he supports it, but he says right before the part I led, when I made up my mind that I would run the risk having law and justice with me rather than take part in your injustice because I feared imprisonment and death. This happened in the days of the democracy, but when the oligarchy of the 30, da 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 da. So that's – does that sound to you also like he's saying that that was the same time as the 30, the democracy? That was unclear to me, but he is pretty anti-democratic. I think that's quite clear.
I wanted to this question of the orders and what sort of orders he needs to obey and the death before dishonor. I want to tease that out a bit from this libertarian perspective because it is – I mean it's a fairly radical notion, right? And especially in the context of military people that you know that there are principles that he thinks were knowable via philosophy, principles of honor, principles of justice, and that those trump the state, that they – you know that the orders of the king, the orders of the democracy are not synonymous with justice and that when they conflict with justice, when they conflict with basic morality, our duty is to these higher principles. It's not to the state, which is I mean important from a libertarian perspective because many of our arguments – libertarianism when argued from a moral background instead of as opposed to say just like a economic efficiency arguments is often like, look, what the state does is morally wrong. It's morally wrong to take people's money in these ways. It's morally wrong to lock them in cages for taking certain substances and that it's your duty to follow morality and not the dictates of the state. But this is – I mean Trevor, you said everyone kind of believes the death before dishonor.
To some degree.
But it's also – it's an extremely controversial thing.
Maybe.
I mean does this mean that – I think it's true that this means that say like a district attorney has a moral obligation not to prosecute people for unjust – under unjust laws and that in fact if they do, they are behaving immorally and should be condemned for it. But you could take it to the extreme in the military. I remember there was a Twitter trending topic a while back of like express your unpopular opinion and – I think it was Will Wilkinson who used to be at Cato and now is not. His thing was soldiers who kill in unjust wars are murderers, which is an extremely controversial and radical claim to make and certainly is not something that like you would have higher-ups in the military saying is the case, right?
I think there's a lot more gray area than you might think.
Okay.
I mean something that's kind of shocking to folks that haven't spent a lot of time with military folks or been in the military themselves. And it's something that I was kind of surprised at. I went through the Naval Academy and then spent 13 years in the Marine Corps. And there's almost a dual-pronged education system there. There is – you would be shocked at the amount of time that we spent in situations like this sitting around and talking about what's the right thing to do and how much it is reinforced that you have to make unpopular decisions. You have to make decisions that are contrary to what somebody told you to do because it's the right thing. And for a lot of folks, they just look at me after I say something like that and they're like, no, that's not how it is. And I go, I'm pretty sure it is. I was there. And you know, that helps you a great deal, I think, in your kind of own, you know, personal moral education. And the troubling thing that you find is that you find people that in the military that ignore that. You know, they've had that training, but they err on the side of you know, not examining that maybe as closely as you'd like them to. But you know, I'm consistently kind of gratified by the number of folks that seem completely at ease, more or less, with, I know if I'm told something to do and it's wrong, that I'm not going to do it, and I'll accept the consequences of that. And it's fascinating. And you know, the kind of trite piece of that is, you know, you make an oath to the Constitution and not, you know, to the orders of your higher ups, right? And the key thing there is that you just have to accept the consequences, right? So no matter what it is that you're choosing to do or not do, you have to accept the consequences. And you know, the example that I always like to give is, you know, Omar from The Wire, where it's, you know, man's got to have a code, right? And a lot of people in the military kind of understand that going in, and you know, there's really, from my experience, a fairly small minority that don't get that, that don't, you know, understand that. And the way that I would describe it, you know, having been to Iraq, is that, you know, I suited up for game time today. You know, I got my uniform on, like I'm here to play, right? If somebody else wants to suit up and get on the field with me, that's fine. They're in the game. But if they're not on the field, they are spectators. You know, they should not have anything happen to them at all, to them or their property or, you know, their family or anything. They are not in the game. And that is something that is, you know, reinforced, I would say, a significant amount in the military. And it's, you know, it's clear in our rules of engagement to a certain extent. There's ambiguity there. There's certainly folks that buck against that. But, you know, with my experience in kind of the counterinsurgency realm, it's how you, I won't say win, but it's how you don't lose.
So how do the military in your program, Combat Classics, like you probably talk about this in regards to apology.
Yeah.
Like, is this something we can learn lessons from in our jobs as military about what happens when you're in a Nuremberg type situation or something like this? Where
I really like the, you know, the people that show up for these are already kind of questioning a lot of things, and they're already wondering, you know, what else is out there as far as education. I mean, you know, another reason that, you know, I started this program was because I was enrolled in Command and Staff College, which is, you know, a requisite for field grade officers in the Marine Corps. And I did that after St. John's, and I just did not have a very good time. You know, it was not something that was edifying and enlightening. You know, when I'm, you know, in Annapolis or in these online seminars, there are these, you know, moments of tremendous joy in reading these kind of limitless works and, you know, just talking with other people and, you know, having them help me learn in the Socratic fashion, you know, what this means. You know, is it logical? Does it make sense? And does it represent, you know, human nature? And if not, where are the flaws? And picking those things apart is something I think that a lot of military audience want to do to a greater degree, because too often it is, you know, it is a Nuremberg example. You know, it is, you know, Lieutenant Calley and Milai. Those are the examples that are drawn out. And so I think that our type of audience wants something like, you know, Socrates' Apology, where it's like, it's not, you know, it's not 100% clear, because, you know, was the state right in doing this is another question. You know, do they have the power to do this? Is it within their purview to do something like this? Was Socrates a threat to the state, and does the state have a moral obligation to act against those kind of threats? And, you know, while I'd love any of your feedback on any of those questions, because that's what I do.
Well, that was part of my question too, and I thought you guys would have more – these accusers, because I wanted to try and get a grip on what the state is in this, because it's not totally analogous to what we would call, you know, post-Weberian, you know, post-Westphalian Weberian definition of a state. But these accusers, if they're real, if they were even real people, which is probably a silly question, but they seem to just represent classes of Athenian society, and he calls all of them idiots, basically. I mean, as Aaron mentioned, like Socrates went around and was trying to figure out if anyone was wise, and he said all these people are really smart, but they're all not wise at all.
Well, there's a wonderful, I love this line, where he's talking about his attempt to go and find people who are wise, and he talks about looking at artists and poets, and he says poets are by far the worst because they think that they are wise but they totally aren't, which is interesting in light of how much he and everyone else cites Homer and other poets as authorities. But he says he's talking about why they might overestimate their wisdom, and so he says because he, someone who is say a very good poet or a very good artist, because he excelled in the practice of his art, he thought he was very wise in other most important matters, and this mistake of theirs obscured the wisdom that they really possessed. And I just – that explains so much of human behavior and political opinions and Washington and
– that's why there's no topic under the sun that Paul Krugman won't write about. Right?
Yeah. Right. Or Aaron's big thing about people who have some knowledge of tech therefore have large knowledge of how to reorganize healthcare.
Yeah, or I went to a dinner with a Nobel laureate who had in economics and had done work on a fairly narrow field in economics, and then received his Nobel Prize, and then wrote a book about basically the decline of America and American culture, and it was everything that's wrong with basically the kids these days. And it was very clear after listening to him talk that his real problem was he just didn't understand what the internet was and didn't understand what he had his tastes, and he liked classical music and so rock and roll was a decline, and he liked Baroque art and so graffiti artists were an example of the end of Western civilization. And so it was this like he thought, you know, I've been awarded this prize. There's no prize that says you are wise more than the Nobel Prize, right? But it was for this narrow thing, and he was very good in that line of his art, but he thought that represented wisdom everywhere else. And this seems to be a very cut. Paul Krugman being another Nobel laureate who thinks he knows everything about everything.
So I mean, going off that, with these critics who represent these different classes of Athenian society, or at least that's the way I read it, who are all called idiots by Socrates and I would say by Plato. And I mean, at this point in Athenian society, is a kind of a democracy, and so there's a huge condemnation of the way that society and the state is currently made up and the kind of idiots who run it, which again, I have to go back to it, but again, it's very similar to Jesus in the trial, because a huge part of the gospel writer's intention was to lambast the Jews who, you know, quote unquote killed Jesus, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, these different groups that were just bad. And so like there's a subtext there in the Gospels. And here we can read Plato's condemnation of everything about it. And then we know from the Republic what he really thinks a good society looks like, and it's not very similar to what the one that killed Socrates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me this – and it might be self-congratulatory, right? But you know, as libertarians we say, I don't know how to live your life. You know, I don't know what you should do with your property. I just know that you shouldn't hurt me, and you probably shouldn't hurt other people too, you know, but a lot of that's none of my business. So, you know, we want to pat ourselves on the back and say to a certain extent, like, you know, we've accomplished some kind of Socratic ideal. I don't know how well we hew to that too much, because I think that our instincts are like, you know, most humans' instincts of wanting to get involved in things that we potentially shouldn't. It also causes me having, you know, because we think we kind of figured it out, right? We think we got, oh, it's property, right? It's property. It's
me, it's libertarians.
Yeah, it's you know, voluntary interaction. It's you know, we've got these principles. And so I think it actually, while we can pat ourselves on the back to a certain degree and say, you know, we have the Socratic ideal of I don't know what's best for you, there's still a long way to go, and maybe I'm not sure that this is actually right, You know, when we, you know, read kind of the foundational authors, if we're reading Mises or Hayek or something like that, even in, you know, technical economic terms, we go, I don't know if this is right, you know. And so I think that, you know, from the libertarian audience, they can get a ton from these kind of seminars, from these kind of readings, and the military audience as well, because the military audience, I think, is also fairly sure how certain things are. But when you actually peel away those layers and you say, well, define your terms, you know, and Socrates doesn't really do that either, you know. But I think that that's probably, at least for me, that's kind of how I found libertarianism, is because, you know, I thought I was part of Team Red, you know, because that's basically what it is, Team Red, Team Blue. And I thought I was part of Team Red, and I was like, okay, let me read about this conservative Republican stuff. And I went, oh, this doesn't make any sense. And you know, you have to dig through those principles, and you have to question and question and question. And when you think you've figured out the right answer, you're probably a militus and you're probably wrong.
Yeah, I think what I especially like about the text and what you just said reminded me of it is that what Socrates does is he's asking his accusers to answer questions truthfully, and they do, and they look dumb. It's this sort of amazing, and I think that's why these are such profound texts, that you read these accusers digging themselves into these logical holes, and Socrates is left with the truth on his side.
So I'm imagining going to a White House press conference and being like, you must answer truthfully now.
Right.
Just making them look like idiots.
Right. But you can – it's sort of a great image to think of these hundreds of people staring down on Socrates asking, you know, I just want you to, you know, just lay it out for people to hear exactly what you think I've done and why you don't like my response. And I think the power of that – I mean I think it's the reason why it remains so poignant, is that it's not some sort of crime novel where there have been trumped up evidence or whatever. It's these people really believe that what Socrates admits that he's doing is wrong, and that's what I think makes it really great reading.
And I think that's what it – your point about even these principles that we as libertarians believe are correct and hold to very strongly, we should have this degree of why and might I be wrong and might I change my mind, which is a point that we make a lot on Free Thoughts, makes this notion – I mean Socrates, when he presents like this is – look, the choice is between, you know, sticking to justice or doing what I'm told, and we want to read the apology as, look, Socrates is standing up for justice in principle as opposed to the Athenians who are just angry at him or want to kill him off. But these are arguments about principle that's going on here. I mean the Athenians think that they have principle on their side, that there is such a thing as impiety and he has been impious and being pious is really important at a basic principle level, and that democracy matters and that respecting your elders matters and that teaching the youth to disrespect their elders or doubt the wise is harmful to society, and that these are important principles. And so they disagree with Socrates on the core principles of what really matters, and that's what the argument is about. And that's a very important thing for libertarians to think about, for everyone to think about, that you're closely – that when there's political disagreement, say, that it's often at the level of – it can happen at the level of principle. That it's not that you are principled and your opponents aren't, right? It's that they hold different views and they may be wrong, but before we condemn them, we should make an attempt to really dig into them, to really understand them, to really learn from them.
And that's a tricky thing, and that's part of the reason why, you know, I wanted to ask about the mindset, you know, because it's always staggering for me to, you know, read any Plato and not put myself in Socrates' situation and just, you know, say, I just want to punch this guy. You know, like it just seems so demanding to both, you know, having done it, I'm sure we've all done something, tried to do some type of Socratic dialogue, and whether you're talking with, you know, another libertarian who's just like a little bit off from what you think is more important, or whether you're talking to a socialist or a Republican or a Democrat, and, you know, you feel that anger begin to swell at some point, you know. I don't either anger or just, you know, you start laughing inside at least.
You mean that they're not giving the right answers?
Yeah. I mean they're not being truthful. Yeah. You know, they're not examining. And so, you know, it's yet another kind of thing that we try to bring to that military audience is saying, like, you know, really, really take a look at what you're sure of, you know, really examine what you're sure of, and then be open to, you know, other interpretations. You know, I had a very fortunate job in the Marine Corps in that I did human intelligence. And so while, you know, while I was in Iraq, you know, a lot of Marines are having language barrier issues. They're having, you know, kind of confrontational issues with Iraqis, where I'm seeing Iraqis who are risking their lives every day to come and talk to me and tell me, you know, this guy is killing people. This guy is killing your guys. This guy is, you know, doing the wrong thing. And I see that level of bravery, and I see that, you know, that level of self-sacrifice. And so I generalize and say, you know, the Iraqis I dealt with were some of the bravest people I've ever met. And, you know, I bring that up in, you know, not in these seminars, but in, you know, just kind of conversations with other Marines, and they just kind of look at me like, what are you talking about, you know, because it's not their impression. But, you know, that really helped me kind of understand the big divergence that can happen within the military between, you know, I'm in the same place as you are, you know, I've got the same things happening to me that are happening to you, and I have this completely diametrically opposed, you know, thing. But it also, you know, it made me go, maybe I'm wrong, you know, maybe I'm wrong about this stuff. And I think that's, you know, very helpful for that military audience to kind of be able to, you know, if they can't do it in a situation like that, at least do it through the lens of Socrates and say, you know, what am I more certain about and what am I less certain? And maybe I should take a look at those.
So we've touched on this a bit, but maybe close by – so your courses, your seminars are for military and ex-military mm-hmm. people.
Yep.
And so the value of – these texts in particular, so these classic texts to – because most of what we're talking about is these are lessons that we can all learn, and we all have – you know, we all see like just a certain side of things and peeling back the layers and seeing the other side is valuable. But what, if anything, in these texts is uniquely important for the military and ex-military audience to learn? And then also I'm just curious, is there – in when they respond to the text in the seminars, is there a difference in the way that they respond to the text if they're active duty or reserve or veterans?
Yeah. I mean, to your first point, you know, what we're really trying to get at is what is the nature of man in conflict and what is the nature of man in cooperation? You know, how do those two things differ? And, you know, the other thing we're trying to offer is an alternative, right? So for me, it was, okay, I can go to command and staff and not enjoy any of this, or I can just kind of go back and hang out at St. John's or start a program like this. And, you know, while the people that need to stay in need to accomplish things like that, at least I can, you know, hope to give them some little bit of a different avenue to educate themselves that might keep them sane during the kind of less sane education that goes on within the military. And I think your last question was
– when they're responding to the text, mm-hmm. Do you see a difference in the way that they interpret or respond to the text if they're active duty versus, say, reserve or veteran?
I think that the biggest difference – we don't see a huge difference with active duty versus veteran or even versus service. What's most entertaining and most enlightening for me is seeing the difference between the more senior and more junior members that come to the seminars. The more senior members have read, at least they think, a decent amount about this and have many times kind of been within a certain worldview for a much longer time. And so they have a lot of problems with some of the bigger questions that we raise, and they're very defensive sometimes about the idea of doing it. Somehow they got harangued into doing it, or just, you know, the idea of asking some of these questions. And the junior folks are much more open to really examining, really critiquing, you know, what the reading means to them and also how it impacts, you know, their military career. And so, I mean, most of the people that stick with the program are really, you know, company grade, field grade type officers. So these are folks that are really in their like late 20s, early 30s, you know, haven't made that step of saying, okay, I'm going to stay in for 20 years. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, if you can just reach like, you know, one or two people, you know, every seminar and get them to really kind of say, wow, this is, you know, not something I knew was this important. It was not something I knew was this rich. And, you know, it's something that they're going to carry with them for the rest of their lives and go, I need to do this.
Free Thoughts is produced by Evan Banks and Mark McDaniel. To learn more about libertarianism and the ideas that influence it, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.